Jacket TTT. Truth Frequency Radio.
Hello and welcome to Enemy Within Radio, going out live on Spreaker.com. Spreaker? TruthFrequencyRadio.com. Got too many shows, Andy. Saturday the 8th of August 2015. Our guest today is Andrew Johnson. Welcome to the show, Andrew.
Hi there, thanks for inviting me on.
No problem at all. Do you want to introduce yourself to the folks listening at home and tell them a little bit about your research and areas, fields of research?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. I consider myself a sort of fairly ordinary person, really. I haven't had any particularly, massive events or traumatic events in my life or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I've had one or two, unusual experiences, but not to the level of, some of the things that I hear about. And I grew up in a normal family and everything, and went to secondary school, grammar school, and then I went to university and I studied computer science and physics. That was at Lancaster in the UK. Finished there in 86, went into working for a company called GEC Electrical Projects, which has long since disappeared. And being absorbed into other companies, and that was to do something called software engineering, which is a bit like computer programming. Mm-hmm. And I worked with primarily with microprocessor-based systems. Eventually, ended up doing some telecommunications work in Nottingham, actually, and I now live in the East Midlands in Britain. And this path that's brought me onto shows like this began in approximately 2003, mm-hmm. although I suppose you might say some of the paving slabs have been laid many years before that, because I had things like I had a UFO sighting when I was about 9 or 10 years old, and that aroused my curiosity in that side of things. And essentially I'd watched a documentary in 2003 about the Rendlesham Forest incident, which was this incident in 1980 where something appeared to have landed in Suffolk next to the Bentwaters Air Force Base, a US-owned base, in between the Bentwaters and the Woodbridge bases, which were twin bases next to each other. And I'd watched this documentary on BBC 3, I think it was, and then I'd done a bit of research on the web and thought, oh, there's something very strange about this incident. And then I discovered this thing called the Disclosure Project, which was an initiative that was set up by Dr. Stephen Greer, and he'd brought forward a number of witnesses from the military, mainly US military, but not exclusively US military, talking about their encounters with, UFOs, flying saucers, and, there was one story that George Filer had told, Major George Filer. He told about this story where a craft had landed near one of the US Air Force bases, and an alien had got out, and somebody had shot it, and this was on the base, this was in the 1960s, I believe. And they came out with various accounts like this, and I sort of read through this testimony, 500 pages of it or thereabouts. I think it was about that, maybe 300 pages, but it was a lot anyway. All from these military witnesses, most of which I'd never heard of, not to the level of detail that Greer had brought out.
Yeah.
And this event had happened in 2001, but I only discovered this in 2003. In other words, Greer organised this press conference at a prestigious venue called the National Press Conference Club in the USA. And, you know, they'd been a 2 hours long, and a lot of the US press had been invited, and some of it had got onto the US news, mainstream US news, some of it. CBS and stuff like that. I'd heard nothing about this in the UK. I found a small report on the BBC news website, which was very inappropriate. You know, UFO spotters slam cover-up or something. I mean, these people weren't UFO spotters. They were, you know, generals in the army. They were in charge of nuclear weapons, you know, in the 60s. All kinds of areas they were involved with. So this BBC report proved to me that there was a cover-up. And I began to realize that was at that point in 2003, I began to realize how serious things had really been hidden from us, you know, in very comprehensive ways, in ways where you were trained to think that certain topics were just totally unimportant or there was nothing to them, you know, or we just weren't worth thinking about. And I think that realization then propelled me forward into a process which has been ongoing ever since, in that I've been researching these topics since 2003, and that initially led me in 2003, probably early 2004, to start looking at the events of 9/11, you know, then re-examining what we were told had happened there, because initially, you know, I hadn't really, I'd just accepted the official story of 9/11 like everyone else. I didn't really have any major questions, you know. And then I began to question that, and I found out about, you know, state-sponsored terrorism, and I found out how the US government had funded various groups like, you know, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. And then that they'd basically set up a database of the Afghan rebels, which then became the database, which was what apparently, so I understand, what the name Al-Qaeda came from.
Yeah.
So Al-Qaeda was this list of pro-US Afghan rebels, which then allegedly, you know, turned against the US and committed these acts, you know, like 9/11, and I think this, I can't remember if I've got this wrong, but this attack on the USS Cole, aircraft carrier, and I think that was attributed to this mythical Al-Qaeda group. So I found out about things like that, and that, you know, Osama bin Laden was apparently a CIA asset, and under the name of Tim Osman. And I was sucked into what we might call this bombs in the building story.
Yeah.
And I what really drew me into that was this. If you look at the towers being destroyed, I mean, we were told they collapsed. They didn't actually collapse. They turned into dust before they hit the ground. And some people might be shocked to know that, but that's actually what happened. And maybe we'll talk about that a bit later. But I was sucked into the bombs in the building scenario, and, you know, I went around telling people, oh yeah, they must have put bombs in the buildings, because we saw these squibs coming out, which are the little kind of, you know, horizontal squirts of material, of dust or debris, which proved that they underwent controlled demolition. And this was what was being put out in the conspiracy movement. You know, the towers underwent controlled demolition, bombs in the building. You know, it's definitely, that's what happened, you know, no question. And you heard all these stories from William Rodriguez that he heard bombs going off under his feet, and he heard that they were planting explosives in the towers, you know, a week beforehand, because there was noises going on the floors above him, you know, and it was all hush hush, and, you know, these strange noises going on in the mechanical floors, which didn't have any offices on them. You know, and all this, so these rumors were planted, and the sniffer dogs were, you know, not allowed to go in the week before and things like this, and there was a power down. And I bought into all of that, you know. And the steel was shipped to China, you know, within a couple of days of the event, and that's why, you know, it was a crime scene that was, you know, destroyed. The evidence from the crime scene was destroyed or taken away prematurely, you know, and I was taken in by that. And I went to an event organized by Jimmy Walter, who was a Florida property developer, very wealthy, apparently. I can't remember, he was a multimillionaire. And he got 100,000 DVDs produced, which he gave away, professionally produced, basically giving the alternative story of 9/11, the bombs in the building story, and among other things. And really, you know, later on, I came to realize that there is a type of connection between what I'd originally started investigating, which was the Disclosure Project specifically, and the events of 9/11. Mm-hmm. And just before we came on air, I was talking to you, you know, just before we came on and discussing this presentation I did in 2012 at the Exopolitics conference that was organized by my friend Anthony Beckett. And that event happened to be at in Liverpool. And I tried to sort of outline, at least as far as I can, the connection between these two situations, these two you know, areas of research, essentially. And maybe we'll get to that later. But, you know, there is so much that is covered up. And the way that the cover-up works is more complicated, I think, than most people realize. And it was really, I think, 3 years after I started to research the Disclosure Project, round about late 2006, I began to get a handle on how disinformation really works and how people can be not only fooled once, but fooled multiple times in their, you know, in their efforts to establish the truth about a topic which they've come to realize is very important. And that's essentially what happened to me with the 9/11 research. And, you know, you can go onto my website, checktheevidence.com, and you can download my free ebook, which is called 9/11 Finding the Truth, which, if I was to describe what it's about, really, it's about the way disinformation works and the way which you can get sucked into it. And it documents how I came to understand the research of Dr. Judy Wood, who I'm going to be doing a broadcast with later today on RBN, later on this evening for UK time, if anybody wants to check that out. So, you know, when I came into contact with her and looked at what she'd put together, I realized that a lot of the stuff which I'd been fed up to then about 9/11 was just disinformation, outright disinformation. And sadly, I think the really hard thing to accept was that people who were giving out that information, they weren't just, some of them were just, you know, what you might call repeaters. You know, they didn't really know enough and they were just repeating what they'd been told outside mainstream news, assuming that anything that wasn't mainstream news, you know, would be more honest, mm-hmm. and more accurate. But I then came to realize that some of these people, you know, they must have known that they were lying. They must have known that they were deliberately putting out disinformation. And that, you know, was deeply troubling, because these people who I'd looked to be sincere and honest in establishing the truth, you know, of what happened on 9/11, were not honest at all. You know, they were actually helping the perpetrators of the crime cover it up by putting out false information. And, you know, again, we were talking a little bit before we came on about these professional trolls,
yes,
you know, and how there seems to be, you know, a real, very strong operation, a very professionally organized operation to manage the way that information, alternative information, you might call it, non-mainstream information, reaches people and how it's presented to them, and it manages what they believe. And I think, you know, this is a huge problem in all the fields, not just in the UFO stuff, not just in 9/11, but you know, you mentioned, was it Tom?
Yep.
Tom Coop. What was his name? Tom Coleman, was it, or
Tom Crawford?
Tom Crawford. Sorry, I got the second name wrong. You know, even with that sort of movement, with the common law and the, you know, establishing your sovereign rights, I think there are, you know, disinformation people in that movement as well, you know, that you've got to watch out for, because if you're not careful, they'll send you down a path which, you know, takes you nowhere, or even gets you into worse trouble than if you hadn't come across it in the first place, you know.
Well, it's been admitted in the mainstream press that governments do have groups of people paid for to professionally troll alternative media and conspiracy pages.
Yes, yes. And I mean, you've got to ask yourself, you know, if they're making statements like that, then clearly we're looking at something which is very important, if they're willing to invest time and funds, you know, into such operations. You know, and things like, you know, the NSA, they must be involved in these high level disinformation campaigns, you know, across all areas.
A good example for me of that, Andrew, was, I don't know if you've seen recently, Colonel Charles Holt, who was the deputy base commander at Bentwaters,
yes,
just been over to Woodbridge, and, It seemed like his entire purpose of his visit was a character assassination on Larry Warren. Now,
oh, really?
You know, there's the man who's responsible for these young boys who are under his control, and far from kind of looking after the interests of Larry over 35 years, he's called him a drug addict, a delusionist, a fantasist. He just picked up things in the mess room, you know, picked it up off the rumour mill, and funny enough, we've got Larry booked on next week.
Well, that's interesting. I'd seen some of the sort of fallout on Facebook of that event, but I didn't actually know. You know, your summary there is actually very useful to me, because I didn't know what exactly had been said, and that's a real shame, because, you know, I'd listened to both Larry and Colonel Holt. And I thought that they were both came across as very sincere. I've met Larry I've never met Charles Holt, but I've met Larry on a number of occasions.
Yeah.
Larry and I have disagreements about 9/11, mm-hmm. But you know, from what he's done for the Rendlesham case, I think is of huge importance, because, you know, as he rightly states himself, he was the guy that got the Holt memo released in 1983 through his own efforts to get some closure on some of the things that he went through, because, you know, Larry seems to have gone through some extremely disturbing episodes after the events.
So what was contained in the Holt memo?
Well, the Holt memo, of course, was this, I mean, even Holt himself had said it was kind of a watered down version of the events at the base. And he said, you know, he sent a small team out into the woods, and you know, they an object came over them, and beams came down, and they watched this, and he recorded the audio of this event, about 20 minutes of it, on this tape, which he later gave to Gordon Williams, who was the base commander. I think he gave it to Gordon Williams, or it eventually ended up with Gordon Williams if Holt didn't give it to him in person. And Holt had described in this memo, you know, just put Colonel Charles Holt Rendlesham memo into your favourite search engine, and you should get a PDF or a JPEG of this. And just describes in, I think, one or two pages, you know, seeing lights in the forest and beams coming down, and the lights had appeared on two nights. I can't remember if he describes Jim Peniston's experiences with walking up and touching the object which had landed. But he may well give a very partial mention of that.
I don't think it's mentioned in the memo, Andrew.
No, I think you're probably right. And I'd have to go and reread it, because it's probably about 10 years since I've actually read that document. But it's very worthwhile reading it. And Holt has, I've heard him say on radio interviews that he never expected that that would become public. It certainly wasn't meant to be a public document. And he was surprised when it came out. And I think, you know, for that, what you just described happening a couple of weeks ago at Woodbridge, to me, fits in perfectly with managing a cover-up. Because, well, you know,
Holt, he continued his career until his retirement, and now he's got a pretty sizable pension, I would imagine. And no doubt if that memo hadn't have gone out with his name on it, he'd probably have made a general. So he's got a bit of an axe to grind, and also the US government have got quite a hold over him with that pension, haven't they?
Well, this is potentially the situation. I mean, I haven't spoken to Holt, and I don't know, you know, I don't know the exact situation, but this, you know, that's certainly one possibility. But I think just looking at the events, if he's going to try and character assassinate Larry Warren, then he's got to be doing that for a reason, whether that reason is because he doesn't like Larry Warren personally, or whether it's because, as you know, as you suggest, you know, he's got a pension deal of some kind, or whether it's because, well, some other reason which we don't know, you know, have all the information for. I don't know, but what is clear is that I would say with my hand on my heart, that is the reason for doing it is one of perception management. Whoever knows what really happened at Bentwaters Base in 1980 in December on those two or three or four nights, whoever really knows what happened and has all the information needs to keep the truth covered up, because the real truth is very, very important, so important that it would, if it was generally known, it would change everything. It would change everything we know about energy, about transport, about money, etc., about the economics that the world is driven by. That is why there is a cover-up in relation to the UFO issue, and why there is a cover-up in relation to things like 9/11. Because the rules of the things like the economy and so forth that we rely on for our slave system, our slavery system, would be completely transformed, or, you know, overruled, or whatever way you want to describe it, if this information become properly understood and properly known about by the general populace, and they actually cared enough about it, which of course is another aspect. So I think that this whole thing that you mention is very much what I would call perception management of the people and the events that were clearly very important in 1980.
There seems to be, there is a different version of what actually happened there, and it seems to me, as an outsider of what actually happened, there's a little bit of an element of wanting to get everybody on one side of the argument, on the one team, especially when there's books involved and there's selling of information. It seems that they want to just put this info out about the other guy just so everybody goes onto his side.
And Nick Pope.
Nick Pope indeed. I mean, Nick Pope, you know, he's a clear example, and I think you're absolutely right. We've seen this with the 9/11 truth issue as well, because, you know, when I was starting to talk about Dr. Judy Wood's research in 2006 and 2007, I'd already become quite familiar with a number of other people in the 9/11 truth movement in the UK as it was then. And at least one of those people, Ian Henshaw, has said that I'm responsible for the collapse of the UK 9/11 truth movement, you know, and this is when I've sort of helped organise, Dr. Judy Wood's lectures in the UK, and I've sent out hundreds of books, hundreds of my own books, and I've given away a free book telling the truth about what my experiences have been within the movement. And so they've tried to play this unity card by saying, well, you know, if you just talk about bombs in the building, we don't have to worry about what the real answer is. We just have to tell people that the official story is untrue. I would imagine that they're doing the same thing with Rendlesham, in that they're just saying, no, we don't really need to know what happened. We just have to tell people that the official story is untrue. You know, that's the main thing. They're probably trying to play this unity card, you know. And this is a very common thing which happens, because I think people, you know, they don't have a lot of stamina, and once they've been given an answer, whether that's by the mainstream or the conspiracy movement, as it might be called, or the truth movement or the alternative knowledge movement, they can sometimes don't recheck that answer very often. They don't go and review that answer in the light of new information and see if, you know, that answer they were given was actually either totally incorrect or partially incorrect. You know, and I think that's possibly what's going on with the Rendlesham case with these people that we've mentioned.
Yeah, it's such a divisive thing, the alternative media and the conspiracy field. And it doesn't matter which field it's in, there's always differences in opinion of what actually happened. But it seems that people just want to be on one side of the argument and want to disprove other sides, like I've said. But instead of just saying, well, I believe this and you believe that. I mean, this show, we get people on with different opinions, that people that don't get on with each other, we get on. Get on separately on this show. Mm-hmm. And that's the way you've got to look at it. You've got to look at it from a critical thinking point of view, and I think that's what you were saying. You've got to scan all the information and make your own opinion. And it doesn't really matter to any other opinion. You're not trying to stop anybody talking. But it seems that people want to do that. They want to stop people talking about one subject and get them onto another. We're just going to break. We'll come back. This is Enemy Within on TruthFrequencyRadio.com. Welcome back to Enemy Within on TruthFrequencyRadio.com with our guest today, Andrew Johnson. Andrew, at the beginning of your introduction, you were talking about what sparked your interest somewhat at UFO sighting when you were 9. What did you actually witness there?
Well, I mean, that was a fairly minor incident. It was just sort of what we call light in the sky. Mm-hmm. And it was basically two acrobatic stars, you know, that as I saw them moving around one another in a sort of figure of eight type motion. I was with a friend who saw it as well, so I knew that I wasn't seeing things, you know. And I was sufficiently knowledgeable at that age to know that this wasn't a star or a satellite or a, you know, plane, or I knew it wasn't any of those things. And, that was the first sighting. I've had three other sightings since then, one in around about 1990, which was a strange luminous object, which I thought was some type of luminous insect, but I don't think it can have been, judging by the coloration of it. I saw that in Rugby in the Midlands in the UK. And then I had another sighting, I think it was around about 2005, of what appeared to be some orbs in daylight materializing, which I thought was a child's balloon at first, but I don't think it could have been that. And then I had another sighting, I think, in 2010 or 2011, when I was visiting somebody in Cardigan, and I saw a very bright white orb traveling parallel, only separated by a short distance, with an orange orb, which I have no idea what that was. We both saw it for about a period of about 5 seconds. It was just flying over the house. We weren't outside. We saw it from inside the lounge, looked through the lounge window, which had quite a restricted view out because it was in like a narrow valley. So I have seen these things several times, but they're just lights in the sky, not these other experiences. And I'd never had any associated new missing time or anything like that. But if I may, I'd just like to go back to an important issue mm-hmm. That we just started talking about just right before the break there. And this is the situation with opinions and people giving opinions, which is all very well. And obviously that's what freedom of speech is about. But one of the themes that I've written about is distinguishing opinion from fact and pointing out when people are lying. For example, should people, you know, class the towers collapsing as an opinion? Actually, it's not an opinion whether the towers collapsed or not. The actual facts of the matter is that they did not collapse. In other words, it's not appropriate to have an opinion about the World Trade Center collapsing, because that's not what happened. It's about, it's like, you know, having an opinion that we're not talking on an internet radio show. You know, it's a fact that we are, and it's a fact that the towers did not collapse. You know, and it's a fact that Larry Warren and Colonel Holt were both involved in the events of Rendlesham in some way. So to have a, to try and argue opinions about those things, that I have a problem with. Now, you can argue about what happened to some extent, but certainly in terms of 9/11, we can prove, you know, that the bombs were not involved in the destruction. They weren't the primary destructive mechanism of the towers. That destroyed the towers. And so people must be very, very careful when looking into this about distinguishing between what they know and what can be proved and what is just a possibility. All right. So if, for example, you have Henrik Palmgren on Red Ice Radio saying, allowing Niels Harriet to say that the towers were destroyed using thermite, people like Henrik Palmgren should be saying, that is wrong. That is wrong. That's not what happened. And the evidence proves that that's not what happened. But one of the big problems with the way cover-ups work is that people like Henrik Palmgren, and I've got a whole article about this on my website, and I'm picking that out and him as a person because of my direct experience, but I could probably pick 100 similar examples with different people and different presenters involved. You know, the point is that when you know something is true and you have somebody, whether they are a mainstream person or an alternative, you know, speaker like myself or one of these other people, and you can prove that they're lying and you are speaking to them on the same radio program, you should be allowed to say, you are lying, sir, and here is the evidence that you are lying. And that's essentially what I've been doing. Now, it's not as a way of trying to get at those people or character assassinate them, and it can often come across like that. It's not about that. It's about establishing the truth and about establishing how the truth is covered up. This is a really fundamental point about one of the things that I'm about. You know, I'm quite happy to discuss, for people to discuss, you know, whether the you know, the rovers are on Mars or whether they're not on Mars, because I don't actually know. And I can't say to somebody who says the rovers are definitely on Mars, I can't say to them that they're lying or they're not lying, because I don't actually know. But there are a number of other topics where we do know. We do know what happened. You know, we do know that the towers turned to dust from multiple sets of evidence. And so people going around saying, well, I don't really know whether the towers turned to dust or not, that's a choice. That's their choice to have that lack of knowledge. You know, ignorance is a choice, in other words. In certain cases, you can establish what the truth is beyond any doubt. And you can do that to such an extent that you can take it to a court of law and argue your case there, even though we know, you know, that has its own inherent problems and pitfalls. So I just want to make that absolutely clear that I'm happy to talk about opinions. I'm not, you know, I'm just making a general point, not a specific point about certain things. But when I know things, I'm going to say what that knowledge is. And unless somebody refutes that knowledge, then I'm going to tell them that that's the truth. And so I just want to make sure that people really appreciate that, because it's a huge problem in the alternative knowledge movement.
And something you point to all the time is the dust and the rubble pile being too small.
Certainly in the example of the towers, that's one of the reasons, because those particular things, the level and amount of dust and the lack of seismic signature, things like that, that proves that these buildings can't have been cut up into chunks and slammed to the ground. You can pick other examples, in the field of ufology or other things, where you've got certain types of evidence which prove that, you know, something could have not have happened that way. You can rule that out as a situation. So we can rule out bombs in the building in terms of 9/11, and we can rule out thermite. Anybody who is now going around saying that they think thermite might have done it or that thermite did do it, they are either misinformed, their ignorance is a choice, or they are helping the cover-up. They're helping the cover-up of 9/11 and preventing knowledge of the truth from being gained by more people. So anybody who's talking about micro-nukes, mini-nukes, thermite, bombs, whatever, laser beams from space, for example, that's another piece of disinformation which has been deliberately circulated. You know, I mean, we've covered some of this with Richard D. Hall, who's, you know, a mutual friend of ours, I know, from how we met at in Nottingham a few months ago. So, you know, so be aware that all these are, in terms of what happened to the World Trade Center, they are disinformation, they are deliberately put out to confuse people, to divide people. The truth should be unifying, and when you know what the truth is and you speak what the truth is, without a personal agenda, without the want of personal gain, that's when you get closer to changing the situation based on what the truth actually is. So quick rundown of the towers.
Yep.
The towers turn to dust. They turn to dust in approximately 8 to 10 seconds. Approximately 85% of the buildings were turned to dust in that 8 or 10 seconds. As you said, very little debris relative to the size of the buildings. Yes, there was some debris. Yes, there were some steel girders. But we have, for example, an ambulance parked in front of World Trade Center number 1 or number 2. I can't remember which one it was. It should have been crushed under thousands and thousands and tons of debris, but yet it's barely damaged. You know, the door is open, it's not crushed. We have cars half a mile away from the World Trade Center. These were actually toasted. The paintwork was kind of seared off somehow, but not by heat. It was seared off by some energy. And then we have the situation where cars 10 feet away from one another, one was had this toasting effect, completely toasted, and the one 10 feet away was not too bad, you know, just a little bit of toasting, not like a real fire. So whatever toasted those cars in the main was not real fire. It was not caused by falling thermite or nukes or anything like that. It was some other process. So people need to avail themselves of the facts on these things. Seismic signature is another one that somebody has just made a film about. A chap called Peter wrote to me a couple of weeks ago, and he's made an hour-long documentary about how programs like the BBC never talk properly about the seismic evidence from the destruction of the World Trade Center. The reason being that if they did honestly report that, it would prove that both the Al-Qaeda story is wrong and the hijacker story is wrong, and it would also prove that the majority of what the truth movement pushes, the thermite story, the bomb story, that is also wrong. That's why the BBC don't cover the seismic signature evidence, because that would prove that something else was involved, which is the energy weapon that was used to destroy the World Trade Center, which is what has been documented by Dr. Judy Wood in her book, Where Did the Towers Go? Which you can get from me if anybody wants it. I'm not trying to sell it, but if people want it, they can get it from me. You can read about it in my book, which is free, free download, or in PDF, Kindle, or audio, you know, EPUB format, I should say. And it's also in an audio book, which was kindly read by Cindy Laverty in the US. She did a great job of that. All free download from my website. No sign up, no registration, nothing like that. Happy to send out DVDs to people of any of this stuff. Just send me a note and I'll send them out. So all that is available for free. We're not a movement. We are about giving people information to empower themselves with understanding what's actually happened there. So going back to what actually happened, the other big thing which people don't really know about is the hurricane. There was this hurricane, Hurricane Erin, which was named as a hurricane, or named as a tropical storm, perhaps I should say, 1st of September 2001. I always talk about this because so few people appear to know about it. And the 9/11 Truth Movement barely talks about it, barely discusses it. It moved up from the Atlantic across to Bermuda, and it hit Bermuda on the 7th of September 2001, coincident with the events of 9/11 is what we're going to come up to. Moved it towards New York City for 4 days, more or less in a straight line, and then it kind of slowed down, it kind of stalled, just as the events of 9/11 were unfolding, moving at its slowest. The storm was at its greatest extent, you know, diameter-wise, and it was 500 miles, the eye was 500 miles from the center of New York, but the influence of the storm, in other words, the electrical field, was apparently felt in all three New York airports because they all reported dry thunder. In other words, a thunderclap without the, you know, presence of heavy rain or anything like that. So that storm then moved off on the 12th of September out towards Newfoundland and was never spoken of again until 2008, when Dr. Wood discovered this in some of her research into the dust plume of material which was rising from the remains of the World Trade Center. So I always talk about this because with that hurricane, you know, you can go and look at the hurricane. It's not an opinion. That hurricane was there. You know, it was really did make those movements I've just described. You can go and check it out on the Hurricane Data Center, NOAA, Canadian Hurricane Data Center. You can check it all on there. All the charts and stuff are all there. That really happened. That's not an opinion. So you have two possible reasons for it being there. One is it was a coincidence. So we just had this hurricane actually move towards New York City and then move away in a way which was coincident with the events of 9/11 and it had nothing to do with it. Or it did have something to do with it. And it would appear, certainly from the research Dr. Wood has done, and I think she's absolutely correct with this, that it's something to do with the electrical nature of the storm, because it's got an electric field associated with it. This, of course, is well established. You know, thunderstorms are have electrical effects associated with them. You know, that's not an opinion; that's a fact. People see it; they experience it every day. And it also appears that the way that the World Trade Center was destroyed has something to do with magnetic fields. Because the Earth's magnetometer readings changed, coincident with the events of 9/11 also. That's documented in Dr. Wood's book, and that data comes from the University of Alaska. It's got something to do with electricity as regards the storm system, and it appears to have something to do with gravity too, because a number of witnesses who were at the towers reported levitation effects, David Hancher being one. And we have a number of cars which are inverted. Again, that's not an opinion. That's what actually happened. You can see that in the evidence. And so you take these things together, it appears that somebody can manipulate materials using something which involves electricity and magnetism. And also it appears to involve some nuclear effects as well, because in one of the sets of readings which was taken from the World Trade Center complex, which was some readings taken from some water at the bottom of World Trade Center 6, we have this compound, not really the correct name, it's actually an isotope called tritium, which is a kind of a form of hydrogen, and it has proton and I think three neutrons. I always get mixed up as to whether it's two or three neutrons. And so this doesn't normally occur except in the presence of some type of nuclear reaction, for example, in a nuclear explosion. Or guess what? It was also found with. It was found with experiments in something called cold fusion. And this was a phenomenon which was discovered in the 1980s, the late 1980s, by two chemists, Pons and Fleischmann, Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischmann. And they did some experiments at the University of Utah in the America. And they discovered an anomalous energy output, an anomalous heat output in some, not all, in some of their experiments. And they also discovered this subform of hydrogen called tritium. And that was also discovered by other researchers such as Dr. John Bokris of Texas A&M University, and it was also discovered by researchers in Japan. And one of the other things which comes out of cold fusion experiments, which are also more correctly called low-energy nuclear reactions or chemically assisted nuclear reactions, one of the other things that comes out is something called transmutation. And this is what also what John Bokris's team discovered in a few of their cells. One element would change into another. So they'd look in a cell after they'd run the experiment, and they'd find some amounts of zinc and copper in the metal on their electrodes, and there was no zinc and copper in the cells beforehand. So this is where one element had changed into another. And this appears to also to have happened in the destruction of the World Trade Center, and we appear to have some type of nuclear or transmutation effect which caused rusting. In other words, steel on the cars turned to rust far more quickly than it should have.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. So this is the sort of evidence that's in Dr. Wood's book. You know, it's not an opinion. That's actually what is seen in the photo and video record and in the witness testimony. Right? So that's what people have to understand. And the curious thing is, to try and tie this a little bit back to the sort of UFO disclosure type stuff, where I went with that in 2003 was into the energy issue, and I started to look up about free energy devices and Tesla, and then found out more about cold fusion, you know, and these other things. And I came across this chap called Dr. Eugene Malev, who was involved in cold fusion research on the periphery of that, and he wrote a book about that in 1991 called Fire from Ice, I think it was. I always get the title, whether it's mixed up Fire from Ice or Fire from Water. And he wrote about another character in his book, in the cold fusion story, and it was actually the guy who came up with the term cold fusion with his colleague Paul Palmer. And I always mention this guy because he's a huge, hugely important figure in the cover-up, and that's 9/11 cover-up, and that's Stephen E. Jones, Dr. Stephen E. Jones, the physicist from Brigham Young University, who, guess what, before he started talking about 9/11 in 2005, when the NIST reports came out, these technical reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center, Jones, guess what his field of research was? It was none other than cold fusion. He did research into cold fusion in the mid to late 1980s. And I've written a bit about that, quite a bit about that, actually, along with some strange experiences related to this fellow. And it was Stephen E. Jones himself, the man who coined the term cold fusion, who invited me personally into the 9/11 Scholars for 9/11 Truth group in the end of 2005. So exactly what is a cold fusion researcher doing, coming out publicly, talking about 9/11 and being skeptical of the government story, when he's been involved in cold fusion research? Well, he's talking about thermite. He's not talking about energy, and he's not talking about the history of directed energy weapons, of which there is a history, which anybody can read about. And you can go and look at things like Lockheed Martin's website or Directed Energy Professional Society website. But crucially, people should also be looking at something called Science Applications International Corporation, which is now split off into another company called Leidos. Science Applications International Corporation I found out about in 2003 because they were named by several, one or more, of Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project witnesses. And they were named, in other words, Science Applications International Corporation, a big U.S. Company, were named as big benefactors of the black budget, money that goes into secret projects such as USAP's unacknowledged special access programs. So how come Science Applications International Corporation was both involved in dealing with ground zero security at the World Trade Center site from the 13th of September 2001, and it was also involved in consultancy work to produce the technical reports about the destruction of the World Trade Center produced by NIST. Am I the only one that thinks this is a coincidence? You know, that's what I'm asking.
Well, it does sound very suspect. You were talking in your talk about the bending of the steel and the known technology that could do that.
Mm. Yeah, and this relates to what I think SAIC actually know, because the bending of certain steel beams, as Dr. Wood will show you in her book, doesn't actually indicate that these beams bent as a result of mechanical loading, in other words, of the building falling down, you know, and stuff falling on top of them. Some of these beams cannot have bent due to mechanical stress or load. They were bent by some other method. And that method appears to have been because the steel itself became like jelly for a short period of time. It became malleable, and it became its physical properties changed for a period of time. And we found out in 2007, I actually knew about this before 2007, but this was when the connection was made, that there's a chap called John Hutchison who'd been doing research into energy effects that he'd created between 1980, well, from the late 70s, actually, but he got good at it in the early 1980s. And he was able to bend metal using a combination of electrostatic fields, microwave beams, magnetic fields, and a radioactive source, which is apparently what was done at the World Trade Center. And this, again, is all covered in Dr. Wood's book. I've got DVDs that cover this because we haven't, you know, haven't had a lot of time to cover this. But in other words, there is a history here, and it's a history which the 9/11 Truth Movement, as I've documented it, has tried to cover up, let alone the mainstream media. And so these beams, to answer your original question, appear to have been bent by using energy in a particular way. And the way that that was done is known about, I would contend, by Los Alamos National Laboratories, because Colonel John Alexander came to visit John Hutchison in 1983 to look at his experiments. And Alexander was working for Los Alamos National Laboratories. I've got documents which prove that. And going back to Dr. Stephen E. Jones, the physicist who was involved in 9/11 research and cold fusion research, Jones also worked for Los Alamos National Laboratories, which is where they originally developed the atomic bomb.
We're just going to break. We'll be back. Welcome back to the second half of Enemy Within with our guest today, Andrew Johnson. Just for the break, we were getting into the physics and the known aspects of 9/11. Somebody in the chat room said, I'm glad your guest also spoke of the hurricane that magically veered off for 9/11. People don't talk about that at all. I think the geoengineering department was told to make sure it didn't hit, as they were going to have an important military exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, we don't know that latter part. We don't know whether there is such a thing as a geoengineering department. But, you know, anyone who looks at that hurricane data, to me, they've got to raise some serious questions. And, you know, sort of going on with that theme, and also that you'd watched this presentation I'd done called The Taboo of Disclosure, I essentially set down that challenge to people, because what I've laid out there for people, and very quickly I know, but it is all true. There is no opinion there that is all true. You know, Stephen E. Jones worked in cold fusion. Stephen E. Jones says, I've got recordings of him on my website saying he worked for Los Alamos. John Alexander worked for Los Alamos, etc., etc. All of that is true. It's not an opinion. Okay, so the connections that you make among those things, or between those things, perhaps I should say, you know, you could argue that was a kind of opinion, but the facts are there. And what I've come to discover, and what the theme of that taboo of was, these topics that I've laid out there, they are taboo. In other words, those people who should be talking about those topics do not talk about them. And I include, for example, Stephen Greer. Now, Stephen Greer, who organized this disclosure project, and his witnesses mentioned SAIC, Stephen Greer will not talk about 9/11 as an event. He will not talk about the research of Dr. Judy Wood. Neither will he talk about the Star Child skull, which was in the possession of Lloyd Pye for a period of time. That's a whole other area. But Stephen Greer, you know, who has a large audience within the alternative knowledge community, he will not talk about the weaponization of energy technology and its use on 9/11. Also, people in the energy movement will not talk about this. And I've approached a number of people and said to them, look, you're wasting your time, because until you start to actually get a grasp of what they've already done with this free energy technology, you know, you're not going to get anywhere with any of these projects that you talk about, because the people in the shadows, they already have done what you're trying to do. They've done it themselves with their own systems. And they can just, you know, they could just wipe you out if they wanted. They can shut you down. They can shut anything down. So until you start taking this on board, you know, I really don't think you're going to change an awful lot, except just open people up to the possibility that you're not going to have free energy devices in general use. You know, it's not going to happen. You have to acknowledge the power of the enemy. That's I think one of the things. And I'd say exactly the same for the people that talk about chemtrails. You know, I have a number of people, for example, that I've corresponded with, about the issue of chemtrails, and as you mentioned that word, their geoengineering, which has started to come into the public's vocabulary in the last sort of 6 or 7 years or so, something like that. Before, around about 2007, 2008, that sort of time frame, the word geoengineering was not, you know, people didn't really know what it was, but they started to put it into the public's subconscious, you know, since then. And there's a chap on Facebook called Max Bliss. Some people may have seen. He posts a lot of stuff about chemtrails and whatnot, and he seemed like a absolutely top bloke, you know. Will not talk about Hurricane Erin. I actually went onto his Facebook page and he's posting stuff about thermite, you know, or somebody that talks about thermite the other day. Yet his interest in geoengineering ties exactly in to what happened on 9/11, you know, and it looks to me very much as if somebody was indeed able to steer that hurricane. I don't know whether they created it from scratch, but if you look at the data, and it's not an opinion, if you look at that data which shows the path, it looks like that hurricane was influenced in some way. That's huge. That is enormously huge. It's humongous, because that right there completely trounces any talk of global warming or climate change. Anybody anywhere in the world who accepts that those hurricane movements were, you know, not natural, cannot then talk about climate change or global warming or anything like that in the same way. To do so is to be part of the cover-up. To do so is to be in denial. To do so is to be in a state of deliberate, willful ignorance, and therefore you are helping the perpetrators keep things covered up, you know. So you've got these huge interlocking areas of energy research and climate research, and yet people still want to talk about bombs and thermite in the building, and that's what they seem happy and comfortable to talk about. You know, what's going on?
Yeah, if I can just backtrack there slightly, Andrew. Stephen Greer, interesting character. I mean, what gets me is he's saying, oh, the CIA have been trying to knock me off, yet he's having breakfast meetings with the head of the CIA, briefing presidents, and we got this serious film
that was,
by sheer coincidence, released just before the citizens' hearings on disclosure, which totally kind of deflated, took the wind out of Steve Bassett's sails with his citizens' hearings, which I thought was an amazing presentation. I mean, the hours and hours of high-level military witness testimony, And now you don't hear anything from Mr. Greer apart from the occasional email saying, give me $5,000 and you can come skywatching with me.
Well, yeah, I'd like to make some comments about that, and I think you're absolutely right. But there's a couple of points I'd like to pick up on. I mean, the Sirius film, I've done a write up about that, of my own sort of conclusions about that. And if you actually watch it, it's actually a repackaging and a watered down version of what Greer put out 10 years ago. You know, 10 years earlier, I should say, because the Sirius film is a couple of years old now. And this little Atter alien, which he talks about in the film, turned out that it was probably human anyway. The most likely explanation is it's some type of deformed fetus. And Dr. Gary Nolan, who was the geneticist in that film, he never says it was an alien. And I know a bit more about that, which I don't know whether I should reveal right now, but I know that Dr. Gary Nolan had meetings with other people about a potential other you know, sort of alien thing, because he was unhappy that this Atta alien, you know, he thought it was probably human from the tests that he'd done. He couldn't prove it was alien, couldn't prove it was non-human, so that was bigged up in the film unnecessarily. Stephen Greer will not talk about Lloyd Pye's Star Child skull. He won't talk about that. Stephen Greer, as I said, he will not talk about 9/11. He didn't talk about it in the Sirius film. And although I thought the disclosure hearings were pretty good, you know, they did try and bring forward a lot of information. Some of it was probably new. It was done in front of a mock hearing. Those senators or ex-senators or whatever they weren't real senators, they were, or congressmen. They were retired, but they were each paid, I think, $20,000, which raises some questions in my mind. I think they were paid a fair sum of money. So the hearings were essentially fake. They were mock hearings, which, you know, okay, I can see why they might have done it that way, but I'm not entirely convinced that was, you know, entirely useful. Stephen Bassett, who you mentioned, I've met Stephen Bassett on several occasions, will not talk about 9/11. He will not talk about the disclosure issue. He will not talk about Dr. Wood's research. I've just written an article about a conference he was at in San Mateo. Last year, in 2014, there was him, there was Richard Dolan, there was Joseph P. Farrell, John Rappaport, and I think a couple of other people. None of them would talk about 9/11 and what I've told you, which to me is central, right in the smack bang in the middle of what happens in black programs. You know, if you're going to talk about anything to do with black programs and weaponization, advanced technology, if you're talking about any of that stuff and you're not talking about what's in Dr. Judy Wood's book, you're wasting your time. You know, at least if you're not giving it a mention and not, you know, referencing it to say you need to go and look at this information. You know, how long does it take to say, I'm not going to talk about what's in Dr. Wood's book now, but you should go and read this book. You can get it at this thing, or go and look at the website, go and read the DVDs. That took me less than 1 minute to say that. You know, I timed it. It's probably 35 seconds. Why did none of those people say that in their hour, 2 hour long presentations, do you think? I would say to you, it's because they're part of the cover up. And if they're not intentionally part of the cover up, they have become unintentionally part of the cover up. You know, and I've been saying this now for 7 years. 7 years, I think, since I've been saying these things. So I would advise people to check out what I'm saying is true, because, you know, I might be just making it up for all you know. So, you know, you can go and check these videos that I've referenced and see them, listen to them all, see if they mention 9/11. I mean, Joseph Farrell, for example, he did this talk. He was there at this conference with Steve Bassett. Joseph P. Farrell has written books about the Nazi paperclip conspiracy and Babylon's banksters and several other books. You know, talking about the secret German weapons program, Nazi weapons program. He even mentions cold fusion. He mentions cold fusion in this presentation he did, I think it was June, just over a year ago, June 2014. He mentions this these experiments done in the 1930s by a German scientist, I forget his name, which were actually a related phenomenon to what's now become commonly called cold fusion. yet he didn't talk about Stephen A. Jones and 9/11 and the potential of what happened, well, what's happened since, you know, with that, which to me was ridiculous. I mean, I know for sure that he knows about this because I've written to him about it. You know, I've got the emails to prove it. So it's not like he doesn't know, you know. So what are these people up to? What are they genuinely up to?
You mentioned about the Star Child skull. This is actually a new subject to me. I just came across it recently.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about the evidence that it's not something like the Sirius small alien? It's not a humanoid. What's the evidence that it's not a deformity? It's not a deformed skull?
Sure. Well, I will definitely go through the evidence now. But if you want to look at a video, anyone that wants to, you know, get the lowdown of this, there's a very good video called Star Child for Dummies, I think it's called. I think I'll just double check that while I'm typing, while we're talking. But Star Child for Dummies is a 15-minute video, and that will take you through all of the evidence that I'm going to describe. Now, the Star Child skull was really the work on this. The most of the work on this was done by Lloyd Pye, who is sadly no longer with us. He passed away in December of 2013, which was a huge shock to me. If you just put in Star Child for Dummies into your favourite search engine, you should get a video, a 17-minute video, which will give you the evidence that I'm discussing now. So it was discovered not by Lloyd Pye himself, but it was discovered by a girl in a cave in Mexico in 1930. It was a cave in an abandoned mine workings in the Chihuahua area of Mexico. This girl, she discovered it along with a human skull. She was told not to go into these caves, but being a sort of exploring teenager, she did. She carried these skulls out of the cave, and I think she sort of had to keep them away from her parents, who didn't want to, you know, told her not to go there. But she kept them until, I think, sort of mid to late 1990s, when she was an old woman then. So I think she would have been sort of 80 years or 70 or 80 years old by then. And then she passed these two skulls on to another person that she knew, but they weren't happy with having skulls in the house, so they passed them on to a friend of theirs, and those friends were Ray and Melanie Young, who live in El Paso, Texas. And Melanie Young is a neonatal nurse, and she is fairly familiar with human anatomy. So she knew that this skull was unusual the moment that she set her eyes on it. And they were both members of this MUFON organization, Ray and Melanie were, Mutual UFO Network. So they then asked around, and they got in touch with Lloyd Pye, who'd done a lot of research into hominids and hominoids, which is things like Bigfoot and early humans and this type of thing. And so he was pretty familiar with different types of anatomy, different types of human anatomy, and deformities and that sort of thing. And when he picked this thing up, he was convinced after a short look at it that it was one of the most unusual skulls he'd ever seen, and he would have it solved within 6 months. Because, for example, he found that the eye sockets were only about half an inch deep compared to human eye sockets. If you put your fingers right in there, they're 2 inches deep. He could see that the shape of all the shape of the skull was completely different. It didn't look like a deformity. It was very symmetric. In other words, it wasn't badly formed on one side and okay on the other. It was perfectly symmetric. He could see that where the neck attached, that was all different. He could see that the forehead was different. Was a different shape. And one of the first things he did was, when he took it to one particular specialist, was the specialist got some bird seed, and they put the bird seed into a jug, and then they poured the bird seed into the skull, and then they tipped out the birdseed, and they found that compared to a human skull of the same size, the internal volume was, I think, 1,600 cc's compared to, I think, it should be 1,200 cc's. So it was much, you know, there's much more space in there. And then, for example, if you feel inside the neck of the skull, you've got a smooth area, whereas in the human skull, it's rough. And this is where the roughness on the inside of the human skull that actually stops your brain from falling down and falling into your neck area. But on the Star Child, it was apparently smooth. So this meant that whatever type of brain was inside the skull was different to human brain. Later on, Lloyd had this x-rayed, and the unusual thing that came up on the x-ray was the size of the ear cavities, which I think were, I think they were different size to humans. I can't remember off the top of my head whether they're smaller or larger, but they were significantly different size. And the other unusual thing, which he thought was unique at the time, was it had no sinuses. It had no sinuses. And humans can be born with no sinuses, but it's extremely rare. Later on, he had the bone tested, and the bone chemistry is completely different. In fact, the bone chemistry makes the bone look more like tooth enamel, human tooth enamel, than it does, because it's got a much higher collagen content. So the bone chemistry is all different. So that, you know, you can't have a deformity where the bone chemistry is that different. The person would be dead, you know. And then initially, what you'll read if you go onto Wikipedia, you'll read that this is a, you know, deformed hydrocephalic skull. That's what you read on Wikipedia, and you cannot change it. In the same way that you cannot create a page about Dr. Judy Wood on Wikipedia, you cannot change the page about Star Child skull. As soon as you change it, it will be changed back again. You can try it if you want, if anyone wants to go and try that. And if you keep doing it, your IP address will be blocked and you won't be able to change anything on Wikipedia. That's a separate issue, though, Wikipedia censorship. So going back to the skull, it was tested in 1999 by, I think it was a police lab in, I think it was in Canada somewhere, and they declared that it was a human skull following genetic tests. Simply declared it was a human skull. This was Lloyd really regretted this because this lab had never worked with ancient DNA. They'd only worked with, normal DNA from the crime scene, which is not ancient DNA. Ancient DNA is anything, I think, over 50 years old. And they declared this result, but they hardly had any DNA that they'd recovered. They had a very small amount, which Lloyd describes in the talk that he gave a few years ago, which I made into a DVD. So, you know, it was declared human when there was no possible way they could make that as a safe declaration. So it was then tested, DNA tested in 2003 again, and they recovered mitochondrial DNA, which is outside the cell nucleus, and it comes down from the maternal line, but they didn't recover any nuclear DNA, which is has the much greater number of base pairs in the nuclear DNA. I think the mitochondrial DNA only has, I think, 120,000 base pairs, I think, or something. But the nuclear DNA has about 3 billion base pairs. And these tests in 2003 showed that they couldn't recover the nuclear DNA, and it appears that the primers they were using were tuned to human DNA, and it would be seem to be the case that they didn't pick up any of the Star Child's DNA because it wasn't human. The mitochondrial DNA was recovered, and they assumed at that point that it had a human mother. So that was 2003, and Lloyd then went forward suggesting that the skull was a hybrid. It was from a human mother and an alien father. That was what he was saying. Later tests, which started in 2010, were done with a new DNA recovery technique. They've now come to show that the mitochondrial DNA is also substantially different to normal human mitochondrial DNA, because they've recovered more of it. And they have now recovered some of the nuclear DNA. And that DNA, I think all of it, so far recovered, indicates that this is not from a human skull. This is some of the DNA sequences do not match any other species in the National Institute of Health database, which has, I think, data for about 100 different species of animals. It has all the genes sequenced. And, you know, for example, humans have some DNA sequences in common with millipedes, you know. And Lloyd describes in this video how chimpanzees, I think, have 98% the same as DNA as us, and they're meant to be our closest living relatives. The Star Child DNA, as has been recovered so far, I think they've now recovered about 6,000 or 7,000 base pairs. From comparing it to the NIH database for humans, it's less than 50% similar. Less than 50% similar. But morphologically, if you look at the skull, it is you know, looks superficially similar to a human skull. But the physical deformities, going back to some of those, the bone is much thinner. The bone is about half the thickness of human bone in the same position on the skull. It's very much lighter as well. So the bone, the actual skull is about, I think, 50% lighter than an equivalent-sized human skull. So the physical differences alone, you know, they say on Wikipedia it's a hydrocephalic. It's impossible, because the X-rays show the vein, where the veins, you know, impinged on the skull. And you cannot see that with a hydrocephalic, because that all gets smoothed out by the fluid in the formation of the bone. You cannot see where these veins go. And also the skull has this dimple. It has a dimple where it dips in the middle. And you can feel this, you know, just with your hands. In hydrocephalic, it becomes like a balloon as the fluid inflates the skull. So you don't have a dimple in the middle. You know, you get a completely sort of round appearance. There's no dimple in it, because it's continually inflating with the fluid. So there's no way that this skull can be a hydrocephalic, as a specialist wants to claim. But Star Child skull, Stephen Greer will not talk about it. It's not in his Sirius film. I don't think Steve Bassett talks about it. I don't think any of these people talk about it. You know, so make your own guess about that. But that's essentially an overview of the Star Child skull, and I recommend people visit starchildproject.com if they want to find out a lot more.
On a slightly lighter note, but still staying on the Star Child skull, I don't know if you happened to see the photographs that Ben posted this week of him posing with the skull.
I did. I was there. In fact, I took. I didn't take the one that was photoshopped, but yeah, that was hilarious.
The question was asked, which one's which?
yeah. But you know, I mean, Ben is. You know, he knows that it's something very strange. I've actually now, and that skull he was holding was my replica copy, which I got last year. I've had that for around about a year now, and I got that replica, you know, at some expense. Because it was one of these crowdfunding things, and I gave some money towards that, and that was one of the perks, you know, one of the rewards.
Let's go on the break.
Okay.
Back. This is Enemy Within on truthfreakreport.com. Welcome back to the last part of Enemy Within on truthfreakreportradio.com. Our guest today, Andrew Johnson. There was a great conversation going on in the chat room, Andy, about geoengineering. Do you want to take that up with Andrew about that?
Yeah, I just brought up the 1952 Lynmouth flood, and it was several years ago before I started really looking into all this that I heard a documentary on BBC Radio, and they seemed to conclude pretty much that it was an early RAF cloud seeding experiment. Which got out of hand, it killed 40-odd people, I think.
Yeah, I've heard about that. That is a peculiar incident, and it does seem that these experiments have been going on for a long time. I think what doesn't get into BBC documentaries is some of the more, what you might call some of the more exotic stuff. I mean, you know, it's, in other words, it's pretty much okay to talk about, you know, planes flying up in the air and dumping powder into clouds, which is essentially what that that RAF experiment near Lynemouth would have been. And the substance they used at that time, I understand, was silver iodide. I think they still do use that in some areas. And this is something I've looked into. But what you won't find discussed, really, are things like the research of Wilhelm Reich, which is, he's the only scientist to have had his books burned in America.
He had to burn his own books, didn't he?
I think he was ordered to burn some of his own books at one time, I believe. Yes, yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's not okay to talk about that too much, at least, you know, not in a mainstream documentary. And also I found that people in the geoengineering movement don't really ever bring up Reich's name. Well, I'd say perhaps I'm being a bit unfair. It's rarely brought up. Reich's name is rarely mentioned in the discussions of geoengineering. And I don't know. It is an opinion. I'll say that hand on heart. It is my opinion that Reich's research does tie into, at some level, the events of what happened on 9/11, because what was Reich talking about? He was talking about something called orgone energy. Energy, in other words, in a word, he was talking about a form of energy, which is exactly what I think, people should be talking about more. They should be talking about this, but they won't talk about the way that energy can be used.
Mm-hmm. Andrew, did you realise there's also a tie-up, quite loose, but there is a tie-up between Reich and orgonomy and the Rendlesham Forest incident?
I am aware of that, yes, because they had, according, I think it was in Peter Robbins, wrote the part of Larry's book where he talks about the cloudbusters that they had there. I think that's in the first couple of chapters, I think, or something, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So he said they had these cloudbusters at Bentwaters. And, I mean, you know, if you've got them on a military base, then you're either doing experiments with them or you are using them maybe to influence something to do with military operations, or it's just somebody who's messing about. I mean, you know.
And then in 1987, the whole of Rendlesham Forest pretty much was destroyed in a freak storm. Those things were still there at that time, apparently. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was that part of this sort of hurricane that, went over London? Or was it?
I believe it was, yes, but
that might have been 88. That one, I can't remember the exact year of that one.
I'm pretty sure there was over a million trees were ripped up and just thrown about like matchsticks.
Oh right, I didn't know that. I wasn't aware of that part of the story. So that's very interesting.
Peter's new book that's available on the Phenomena magazine website for a free download is kind of really a response to the book that Nick Pope did with John yes. Burroughs and Jim Penniston, there's accusations of plagiarism there from Peter, and that book's a free download. It's in seven parts, and the actual book is about 78 pages, but the whole download runs to about 500 pages because it's the biggest online archive ever released of documents relating to the Rendlesham Forest incident. It really is worth looking at, if anybody hasn't got it.
Yeah, that's good. I should take a look at that. I think I might have some of those documents already, possibly, but not the actual book, so that's very interesting, yes. You know, again, I mean, I met Peter Robbins briefly. He probably wouldn't necessarily remember him, but I met him in 2009 at the Liverpool Beyond Knowledge Conference, and I tried to introduce him to the Hurricane Erin stuff, but he didn't seem interested, you know. And this surprises me because, you know, as you say, he's pointed out the cloudbusters at the Rendlesham base, and I've heard him talking about Wilhelm Reich's cloudbuster. I think he may have written a whole book on that stuff, you know. So for him not to be interested in evidence of geoengineering being employed around the time of 9/11, to me, it doesn't make any sense, you know. Why aren't people talking about this, you know?
Well, also, we just had a comment there in the chat room. Kate Bush was trying to tell us
yes.
in her songs and cloud busting, which she was apparently a very regular visitor to Rendlesham Forest at one time a day.
Oh, was she? I did not know that. But yeah, I knew about the cloud busting song. I mean, I play that in a presentation that I do about chemtrails and geoengineering. Again, that's on my website. And if anybody wants a DVD of that, it's on YouTube as well, of course. But yeah, so yeah, absolutely. And you know, what was Kate Bush trying to tell us? What her song was inspired by was the book by Peter Reich, Wilhelm Reich's son, called The Book of Dreams. And you can find a PDF of that online now. But they've just, in fact, somebody sent me, they've just reprinted it in the last few months. So there's a new 2015 edition out called The Book of Dreams by Peter Reich. It's not very long. It's only about, I think, 80 pages or something. So again, that tells some of the story of Wilhelm Reich. It's a little bit repetitive in a couple of places, but it's a very interesting read. It's more like a memoir than a textbook or anything like that, but it's definitely worth reading.
I believe Peter's trying to get some funding together to do a proper documentary about the life of Wilhelm Reich.
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that. What I do know is that there is another documentary in the works, because I contributed, I don't know, about $100 to it or something last year. There is a new film about Reich in the works. There is also the Reich Museum, which is at Organon. And I should know which state in the US it's in, and I can't remember. I should know this, but you can go to the Reich Museum if you're in the US. It's open to the public, I believe. At least, if not, you know, all the time, it's open on selected days or on selected holidays and stuff. So check it out. Go and check out the Wilhelm Reich Museum if you want to actually go and see the place.
Getting back to the 9/11 thing, you touched upon the towers, and I did want to talk about Building 7. So was Building 7 exactly the same as the directed energy weapon?
Well, that's a very good question, because, you know, they've had whole truth movement campaigns based on the knowledge of Building 7. And I'm sure most, if not all, the listeners are familiar with the facts that it was destroyed around about 5:20 in the evening. And, you know, this was no planes nearby or anything. The whole 9/11 plane story is more complicated than most people think. And it was, you know, we had this report from Jane Standley of the BBC where she said it had been destroyed or collapsed. And it hadn't, you know, it's in behind her in the background. There's that famous story, which again is, I think, part of the Easter egg hunt. And then the Architects and Engineers Group, which is headed up by the well-known liar Richard Gage, they claim that it was bombs in the building, you know, and molten metal in the basements. But the problem with the bombs in the building, again, here is the same as with the towers, is the seismic signature when the remains of the building hit the ground does not add up. It had a 0.6 seismic signature, which is barely distinguishable from just background rumblings of the, you know, that were normally going on with road traffic and, you know, and things like that. And that data is all available. It's mentioned in Dr. Wood's book. Hardly went across the street. And the other killer is the sound. You can actually see, if you look for these clips, there are, I think, at least two clips on YouTube where people are being interviewed about, you know, the horrible things happening on 9/11, and Building Number 7 is being destroyed while they're being interviewed. And one of them, I think, is, you know, just like five blocks away, and you can't hear it. You can't hear anything. You can't hear these pop, 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 bang, bang, bang charges going off, you know. It's not controlled demolition. It's not the use of pre-planted explosives. Cannot be that, because the evidence that we have, both the seismic and the audio evidence, you know, contradicts that. It cannot be that. So if you're going around saying it, oh yeah, you know, towers 1 and 2 were an energy weapon, but tower 7, that was definitely controlled demolition, again, you're helping the cover up. It's not what happened. So we can be sure that Building Number 7 was destroyed without using controlled demolition. It appears to have been a different mode of operation of the same type of weaponry based on the evidence we have, because the building essentially was turned to dust over a longer period of time, possibly from, well, it looked like it was done from the inside out, judging by what was coming out of the building for several hours. I can't remember how many hours, but it was, you can see some of the videos of these fumes coming out for, I think, 4 hours or something like that, maybe longer. And it appears that these fumes were actually the remains of the building, you know, this building being turned to dust. while people were wandering around the streets.
There's a good point in the chat room about the report of the lobby being blown up. I was going to bring up with about the towers that the firemen saying that the lift shafts blew up.
Yes, yes.
In the base of the building. Well, what's your thoughts on that?
This is, again, a common sort of problem that we have with conveying this information and the brainwashing which has taken place by the truth movement. Simple facts of the matter are that bombs explode, but not everything that explodes is a bomb. So just because you hear an explosion doesn't mean to say that it's a bomb that caused that explosion. So, for example, some of the explosive sounds were structures being disintegrated by some other method. We know, for example, from witness testimonies by the firemen, and you can read these on the New York Times website if you want to, or you can download the text files from my website. Again, anybody who has a specific question about any of this can write to me on the contact button, and I'll point them at the various links to back up what I'm saying. But the firemen said, several of them said, one or more of them said at least, their air tanks, which are called Scott packs, I've called them oxygen tanks in the past, and that's incorrect because they're actually air tanks. They were exploding on the back of the trucks. They had them still on the fire trucks, you know, parked in the street, and they were exploding. So is that a bomb? Were bombs planted in the oxygen in the air tanks of the firemen? Do you think? You know, that's a rhetorical question, of course. And we have reports of explosive sounds in the towers. But what I would say to people is that we've documented how the materials that made up the towers were being affected, were being disintegrated by this form of energy weapon, which operates on a principle or appears to operate on a principle of field interference. So what's going to happen if you have a fire extinguisher with a pressurized tank and a metal exterior? If that metal starts to weaken and crack, what is going to happen in terms of the fire extinguisher? It's going to explode. So I would contend that a lot of the sounds which were called bombs by the truth movement, perhaps because these ideas were planted deliberately, were not bombs at all. They were actually exploding tanks, such as fire extinguishers, such as water tanks, which were in the towers. I don't think there were any gas tanks, so they weren't allowed to have pressurized natural gas or anything like that, or liquid gas in there. But there are many other examples. Some of the toilets had a pressurized flushing system that would cause such an explosive sound to be heard in quite close proximity to where people actually were. Same goes for building number 7.
So that's the explanation for the lift shaft. The lift's actually exploding because the eyewitness, the fireman, said that the actual doors blew open.
Right, right. Well, that could have been triggered by some other type of explosion further up the lift shaft or in the lift itself. There may have been some pressurized tank inside the lift mechanism. You know, if it had some type of hydraulics in it, for example, that could have triggered an explosion, and that which caused the doors to blow off. You know, any number of sort of reasons for that. But even having said that, let's just say for the sake of argument, you know, because people have so much difficulty getting over this issue of bombs, let's just say for the sake of argument, I don't think it's correct, but I can't prove that it's not correct, is that somebody planted some bombs somewhere in the towers, in the lift shafts or wherever it was. Don't people know about bombs? Don't people know how they work, roughly? You know, we know what bombs do. I'm not interested in what bombs do. I know what they do. I'm more interested in what these energy weapons do and can do and have done and who owns them. Don't people want to find out about that? Or they just want to talk about bombs and thermite, which is apparently what they do. They're not interested in the other situation with the energy weapon, that people don't talk about that. So this shows you the way that the cover-up is managed. People are guided down blind alleys or alleys which don't really, you know, teach you anything other than what you already knew.
I was just going to say that the official story of why the lift shafts exploded was fuel coming down from the planes, but there was only one lift shaft that actually went to the top of the building. The rest went to different floors in the actual towers. I think that's just to throw it out there, just to put people off track anywhere. Because if there was tanks or something else, then it gets them on a different thing anyway.
I would think it was. I mean, the whole thing, which you know, we discussed earlier on with the towers turning to dust, that is rarely discussed on any TV programs. It's very rarely discussed on any 9/11 Truth websites. You know, they talk about anything other than that, you know, put options, you know, Jewish influence, Israel, Zionism, you know, which I'm not saying is not relevant. I think that is relevant. But to me, if you want to find out who did it, you have to find out who has the weapon, you know, and all these other things, they're not really good. They're going to just lead you to places which, you know, not really going to teach you anything. Whereas this, we can see there is a whole new field of knowledge, which has been, which would, if we knew more about it, would change the way that we live and change the way that we can live. And that's why I keep banging on about this to people. It's so important that they start to investigate this for themselves, you know, rather than all these kind of Easter eggs which have been planted in front of them, you know, to I think as you said, distract them from what actually happened.
Mm-hmm. We've got Dottie asking there in the chat room. So were these planes holograms or what?
Well, I don't know exactly what the planes were. I can tell you what they weren't, and that's that they weren't real physical, you know, aircraft with two engines and two wings. Because if they'd been real physical engines and real physical wings that crashed into those towers, they would have behaved like real physical objects. And all the evidence that we have shows that they didn't behave like that. And if you look at all the videos, you don't see, you know, if you think of a Formula One crash, for example, you know, a car crashes into the barriers or whatever, and it spins round, but bounces all, you know, back and forth. It, bits fly off and go all over the place, and it's a horrible mess. But somehow, if you look at the Flight 175 video, that's the alleged second plane, it just goes into the building. You don't see any large pieces. None of the wings break off. The engines don't break off. The tail section doesn't break off. You just get a few little sort of pieces of small bits of debris, bits of dust, little bits of short pieces of debris, maybe, you know, 5 feet long or something. Not even that.
A big aluminium can full of people's farts is not going to cut through massive steel girders like that, is it?
No, exactly. Exactly. Now, people will argue to protect both the official story and the Truth Movement's version of events, which can include pods or, you know, remote-controlled planes or, you know, some other variants. They will argue that it was because of the speed the plane was traveling that that's why it behaved the way it did. This is nonsense. You know, if you could pierce something just by making it travel faster, then you would never develop armor-piercing bullets, you know. And if you were to fire a, you know, 4.4 Magnum handgun, which is a very powerful handgun, at a steel girder, what's going to happen? That bullet isn't going to go through the steel girder. It's going to bounce off it. So it should have bounced off and fallen to the ground. That's not what happened. That is not what happened. The plane absorbed the building. And if you look at the hole, you can't even see any pieces of the plane hanging out. You know, you wouldn't have expected it to have gone perfectly in the hole. By whatever, you know, physics you stretch it to, there would have been some bits, you know, that got caught on the edge or dropped down or were left hanging out. There's no suitcases, there's no fabric, there's no bits of seats, there's no bits of cockpit, there's no bits of tail, no bits of wing, there's nothing. There is nothing sticking out of that hole. It's just
To be fair, Andrew, they did find an engine a few streets away, but apparently they dropped off the wrong engine because it wasn't the type of engine that was fitted to the aircraft which was supposed to have hit the towers, was it?
Exactly, and that's in the NIST report. And the other giveaway with that one is simply that if that engine had landed there, there would be a crater there, or near where it had landed if it had bounced. So, you know, that none of this is talked about. So the important thing to establish initially is that those plane crashes cannot have been real. And then you go into the other investigation, which says, well, so what did crash? Did they simply crash nothing, you know? And then you've got people like Simon Schacht claiming that it was all video fakery and there was no real plane crash. Doesn't explain the evidence, because I've spoken to people didn't see the plane and they were right there, and people that did see the plane. So if you read the witness testimonies, it appears that some people did actually see the planes and some didn't. It would depend where they were standing. And if again, if you look at some of the videos, and I've got a little video of this in the presentation that I do, it appears that on some of the videos, the wings, one or more of the wings of the plane, that's Flight 175, appear to temporarily disappear. So I would argue that whatever this was, you know, you could call it a hologram, I think it's not ever such a bad name for it. I tend to go with the image projection name, some form of image projection that was used. Then I think the image projection system wasn't perfect. In other words, depending on where you were stood or what equipment you might have been filming it with, you might have ended up with a slightly imperfect image.
Just coming up to the last 3.5 minutes of the show, is there anything that you want to say, any other subject that you want to touch on, or do you want to give out any information of what people should look at on the subject that you've talked about?
Sure, we'll just have a sort of slight recap, and that's that, mm-hmm. you know, as I've come to see it, a lot of these figures in the truth movement have another agenda. What causes them to have that other agenda, I don't always know. But another quick example that often comes up is Edgar Mitchell, Dr. Edgar Mitchell, the alleged sixth man to walk on the moon, or as I've said, the sixth man to never walk on the moon. And he's a prime example of somebody who's been used within the truth movement to spread false information. And I recently posted an article about that in response to an article that had appeared in UFO Truth magazine this month. So there's that, and that brings me on to the UFO Truth conference, Gary Heseltine's conference, which is going to be held in about 6 or 7 weeks' time.
19th and 20th of September, I believe.
Correct. In Holmfirth, which is not North Yorkshire, I think it's South Yorkshire, Glasters. I won't be speaking there. Richard Hall is speaking there. I'll be having a table there. So if people do want to come and speak to me and just have a chat and, you know, pass the time of day or whatever, watch the world go by, I'll be there. I'm not sure whether I'm going one or both days. I'll probably post something on my website when I'm more sure about that. But I'm just going to sort of sell a few books and DVDs if I can, and just talk to people if I can't.
Good chat then, Andrew, because we're doing the show there from there on Saturday.
Oh, great. Okay, yeah, well, we can probably have a chat there then, I would think. Mm-hmm. So I've got that. That's the next thing I'm sort of involved with. I am going to be speaking at Anthony Beckett's Exopolitics conference in October as well. I'm doing the Secret Space Program talk, which I think is going to be on the Saturday. So it's an opportunity for Richard Dolan not to talk to me again. but that's another story, which is on my website. So there's that. I will be doing a show with Dr. Judy Wood, as I said, later today on RBN. That's going to be 3 hours with millions of breaks. So we might get a couple of minutes to talk in between the breaks. You never know. So there's that. Any of the stuff that I've talked about, I'll reiterate. Please, if you have any questions, comments, if you know that I'm wrong, then please do write to me. At checktheevidence.com, click on the contact button, and just drop me an email that way. Either, you know, with your email address or without it, you can do anonymous email if you wish. And as I say, keep your BS meters tuned. Keep them fully tuned. And you know, you're going to have a news broadcast in a minute. And of course, I had to smile when I was hearing those, but maybe the less that I say about those broadcasts, the better, really. You know, we know Obama's not in charge. You know, he's just a puppet. You know, so that why they're even talking about him, I don't know. Well, I do know, obviously, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for coming on the show, Andrew. It's been an absolute pleasure. It's been a fascinating talk. Please check out the Facebook page. It's Enemy Within Radio, all one word. Or if you're searching for it on Facebook, it's best to type Enemy_Within. It's at Enemy Within Talk on Twitter, and it's www.enemywithinradio.com. See you later, folks.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew.